everybody. Welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am your host, as always, Andrew Farmy. With me, Farmy? I'm Andrew Farmy now.
Welcome to the Andrew Farmy Show.
I apparently can't even pronounce my own name. Andrew Farmer. And with me, as always, is my co-host and producer, the Jedi Cole Houston, the Empire Builder over here, the Kingmaker.
Could be
Houston. My friend Kieran Houston.
I'm actually Cure Dulay from 2001 A Space Odyssey.
For all of our Dutch friends, that's hello in Dutch, from what I understand. You have joined us at the tail end of a fantastic story arc that is Hey Kids Comics Revisited. We have been down a rabbit hole from our youth in the podcasting realm for Hey Kids Comics. We've been revisiting our first ever story arc. It's been great.
I'm just putting money on whether or not you can pronounce the story arc.
I can pronounce the episode.
Comic book shop confidential.
That was our first ever story arc, our first five issues in Hey Kids Comics, and we were young and full of life and vigor. And we're going back now and talking about things we might have missed, things that we wanted to talk about. You know, have things changed in the past year and a half since we started? Have things gotten better? Have things gotten worse? What did we miss in those story arcs? So that's where you find us. I hope you've enjoyed the first four issues of this arc. Now we're on to the fifth and final issue of this story arc, which you've joined us at issue 93, which is HKC Revisited, Holding Up a Mirror to Reality. I can get that right.
Ah, very good.
Right, and so we're revisiting our fifth issue of Hey Kids Comics, and essentially the impetus of this issue was what happens when reality kind of creeps along into comic books. And in this issue, I'd like to talk about the reverse too, when comic books kind of creep out into reality, because what we've seen is this acceptance of comic book culture within the kind of mundane society. So we're starting to see a lot of things come out of comic books and into modern day society that wouldn't have done so before. And it's gained a general acceptance, so we're seeing some of these things that we've always wanted to see, or some of the things we didn't want to see.
That's so true. The thing is, that's something that really never occurred to us to go in the reverse back the first time.
Well, there wasn't necessarily a cause to, because what we were seeing in the first one is we were starting to see the big comic book movies be released, and traction being gained by this community and being pushed out into modern culture. Now it's kind of happening wholesale with the movies, with the TV shows. People are using. I mean, what was the big one from X-Men, Days of Future Past, the movie that everybody was up in arms are just because they were awful? Was it Carl's Jr. or was it, I can't remember the
oh yes, Carl's Jr. Yes,
the awful commercials that had the stars of the movie in it hawking their wares on TV, which never would have happened 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, you know, you might have like seen Popeye's Chicken building, you know, a restaurant slathered all over a Supergirl, but you wouldn't have seen, you know, Helen Slater doing a commercial for Popeye's Chicken, largely because Popeye's advertising arm has a lot better taste than one good actress to.
Wow! We're on the offense immediately. We're into attack mode straight off the jump. So things like that.
I'm still hurting from Leave This Place and Do No Harm.
What was that from?
It was from the Supergirl movie.
Oh God, yeah, because we just did a thing over at United States of Geekdom where we're currently the bologna in the fried bologna sandwich of Super Month. where we're going through all the Superman iterations, be it, you know, movies or TV shows or radio, all early years, late years, middle years, all the years. So a lot of that stuff's fresh in our mind right now. So the last issue, we missed some things. We talked about some things. I know we kind of dwelled kind of heavily on, because it was the first time we had a chance to talk about it. I think we dwelled kind of heavily on 9/11, just because we talked about Captain America and how real events kind of make their way into comic books.
Well, and how how sometimes they try to inject a little of the real world in. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And I think the biggest problem is because comics are timeless, because a month in the comics could be 2 days.
Right.
Or 2 years in the comics could be a few weeks. The problem you run into when you let too much reality sink in is that, you know, why are we still, you know...
Why are we still talking about this?
You're plowing through presidents awfully fast. Or
yeah, you've gone through 17 presidents, yet Peter Parker's still a senior in high school. There's something not right about this. No, absolutely. One thing you brought up to me when we were talking about the issue was the presence of Barack Obama in comic books. I think he's the first. I think he would be really the first comic book president, as it were. I know there's the big one, which was Spider-Man. I forget which issue of Spider-Man now. Wow. I'm a horrible host, but he made the cover of Spider-Man in a big way. And there was one that came up over and over again in my searching. A real life person that has made more comic book appearances than any other person in the history of time. I will put money. I'll put large sums of money on that, and that is one Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, I guess if anybody's been featured, any real character has been featured more than anyone else ever in comics, it's Hitler. Certainly, Obama is the first president to be featured repeatedly, get lots of coverage in comics, more so than most. Prior to that, I know that Jimmy Carter actually signed the pardon for the Incredible Hulk.
Yes, he did.
In fact, you can see on the cover of that issue him scribbling his brand across the official document that forgives the Hulk for all sins and transgressions.
Yeah, I remember that. By the way, it was number 583 was the Barack Obama inauguration Spider-Man cover.
Yeah, I bought you a little time there.
Thank you for that. Because I think what happened was in 2008, Barack Obama did an interview, and there was one of those public interest things you might not know about Barack Obama when he was running or when he, you know. And one of them was that he collects Spider-Man and Conan the Barbarian comics. So at least he has 50% good taste. I'm not going to say that Spider-Man is the best thing to collect, but definitely Conan. I'll give him Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
But Spidey Meets the President was the issue of Spider-Man.
I think, though, they went a little too far with Conan Meets the President.
No, I think
that was troublesome. I don't know if that threatened for them to lose the license from Robert E. Howard's estate or what.
I don't know. I think maybe the Young Blood and Savage Dragon special variant president covers from WonderCon might have pushed it a little far too. You know, you don't necessarily want, if you're running to be the you are the leader of the free world, you don't necessarily want to appear on the cover of a comic book with a giant lizard man that fought God in a battle of fisticuffs, naked in the shower, with his lizard parts all hanging out. That might not be the best thing to do. He also, I did not know this, he appeared in Flashpoint, the DC Flashpoint, the big crossover that led to the New 52. Having a conversation with Amanda Waller about the Green Lantern Corps I did not know that.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, so...
Now, I remember one thing that sprung to mind that I don't think I saw anywhere in... was, I think, when Black Panther was relaunched about 6 or 7 years ago. What was it? They did that relaunch where, you know, they were... like the U.S. was trying to come muscle in on Wakanda and get their strategic vibranium
reserves.
Yeah, and there was this whole part of the story where this character was introduced who was blatantly Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah.
And somebody referred to her as either, I think they referred to her as Dondi. Like, oh, is this Dondoleezza Wheat or something?
Dondoleezza her. It's, we're back to Dutch again. All right.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I can't think of there have been other presidents that were in comic books, like that appeared in comic books, but I don't think any of them had the presence that Barack Obama has had in comic books. So there's that, like, the public figures appear in comic books all the time now. That's just kind of a thing that happens. Now that they've gained general acceptance, and now that we know that, you know, Barack Obama and God knows who else in the public sector read comic books. It's not the niche market that everybody thought it was, especially not with the movies bringing in more people and the TV shows and things like that. There's definitely a ramped up interest in comic books. So how weird, what do you think was more weird for Barack Obama? Do you think going to his first G8 summit or appearing on the cover and within the pages of Spider-Man?
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like, if for a comic book fan, no matter who you are, no matter what, you know, echelon of the social stratus you reach, appearing in the Amazing Spider-Man as you know, a featured part of the story has to be a pretty big deal. Has to be.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of like, you kind of question what was more exciting, you know, Inauguration Day or the day the issue of Spider-Man
came out. Right. I can tell you what it would be for me.
I can just imagine, you know, the president, like, look at this, I'm a congressman. You're the president of the United States. You're the most powerful man in the free world. And
who cares?
I'm on the cover. Are you on the cover? No, I'm not president either. Don't you get it? I appreciate that. That's pretty cool. But, you know,
right,
most people's moms aren't thinking that one day their child will be on the cover of Spider-Man. They're more thinking maybe President U.S.
And the chief of staff of the Secretary of State, whoever it is, comes to, you know, Barack Obama and says, "All right, Inauguration Day is this day. It's on a Wednesday. Whoa, wait a second. I'm the leader of the free world now. We are moving Inauguration Day. Inauguration Day cannot happen on the same day as New Comic Day. We've got to shift this to Tuesday or Thursday. It cannot be on a Wednesday. It can't happen. My issue of Spider-Man comes out that day. I'm not... get the Secret Service together. We're going to roll down to the comic shop. We're going to pick up a couple of these issues. It'll be fine." When I was looking at Hitler, because obviously Hitler played a big part in, like, the World War II comics, right? Like any of the Invaders or Captain America or, you know, Superman, everybody had a crack at punching Hitler at some point in the face. That was like playing jarts for the time period. It was really a carnival game of sorts. But the one that got me the most was that Hitler not only infiltrated most of Europe, but also the storyline of Captain Planet. And it's just too good to pass up. I had to bring it up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the animated TV show of Captain Planet. And it's not a comic book, but I'm looking through it. I'm like, okay, so Hitler was in the Invaders, granted. Hitler was in this. Hitler was in that. Hitler was in Captain America. And then I'm like, wait a second. Hitler was in Captain Planet?
I think it's almost a given to, especially in comics, to do Hitler stories. You know, back when I was in high school, I was goofing around on the blackboard one time, and I created this character called Stripes the Cat, and I wanted to do a little, you know, self-published mini-comic of Stripes the Cat, and pretty much right off the bat, the first storyline I had was this whole big quest for Hitler's brain.
Okay.
And in the story, I envision, you know, you have this glass jar with a brain in it that has a little Hitler mustache.
Oh, that's awesome.
You have to be able to distinguish.
That's awesome.
You know, that it is, in fact, Hitler's brain.
Right. How else are you going to know it's Hitler's brain unless you throw a little mustache on it?
Right.
No, but I think Hitler is the softball villain of comic books. It's real easy. He's the public domain softball villain.
Villain, you know, you bring him up to the majors from time to time.
Right, you bring him out of the farm leagues, you bring him up to the pros, and it cracks me up, because, like, the storyline apparently was that Hitler, what did he do? He only had one, yeah, he was so his hatred was so powerful that Captain Planet was weakened by his stare. Yeah.
That Care Bear stare.
So apparently prejudice is its own superpower.
It's like the opposite of the Care Bear stare, I guess. It's like the, you know, hate bear.
I hate to break this to you, but if prejudice was a superpower, all of Phoenix and anywhere I've lived in my life would be like Astro City. There's just everybody flying around and punching people. That's what it would be like if prejudice was a superpower. But yeah, you know, Hitler, great. Okay, we've talked about Hitler now. We've given our obligatory Hitler talk. There was another thing that we came across during our research, because we actually, first of all, let's take a second to acknowledge the fact that we actually researched, which is a big step for us.
Yes, and I was really impressed because, Andy, you sent me a mountain of findings
of actual research. Yeah.
And I was surprised to find, you know, there were things I was aware of and things I wasn't, and thank goodness there are people who take the time to you know, do that kind of digging and
right,
and put that out there for all of us. You know, I goof around on some stuff and occasionally put out the odd thing worthwhile, but most of it's crap. You know, like goofy things I come up with to entertain myself and hopefully others. But you know, some of this stuff is just downright amazing things I never would have known about.
Well, the one that really struck me was, and we'll go ahead and cite sources. Cracked did an article. It was a while ago, but it was an article about kind of the prescience of comic books, like when comic books sort of predict what's going to come in the real world. And what we came across, you know, there are things like the atomic bomb, which was introduced into Superman in 44, and then, you know, was released wholesale in 45, which isn't a stretch, because atomic energy, we were discussing it, you know, as a nation. It was a national topic. So yeah, it's going to factor its way in. But some of the storyline, you know, parts were a little creepy in the specific ways that they worked, and then it kind of veered off into comic book land, you know, into weird surreality. But one thing we noticed as we were going through this list was things like the Challenger disaster. I'm sorry, Catherine, to be bringing this up, but the Challenger disaster, when the Challenger exploded, and I remember vividly where I was when that happened. What I didn't know was at the same time that this was happening, there was a comic book being made, and it was the relaunch of the Man of Steel series.
Yes,
which was the relaunch of Superman, which has only happened 375 times. But for this particular one, the issue
was the post-crisis launch, which would have been about the time that I was in college.
Like 85, 86?
Yeah.
And they had to go back and scrap the issue, or at least change it up some, because the whole idea, and it was, and the weird thing about this is it was supposed to be released, I believe, on the same day as the it wasn't. This isn't one of the ones that was supposed to be on the same day, but he was supposed to have been saving a NASA space shuttle. That was the kind of your reintroduction to Superman, was him saving...
Yeah, it was the space plane. I remember when that came out.
And yeah.
I thought that was really kind of cool that John Byrne extrapolated beyond the idea of the space shuttle into, like, an even bigger vessel. Ultimately, maybe like a precursor to commercial space travel type of thing. And, of course, Lois gets the exclusive onboard interview thing.
Right, and let's not forget the fact that you just said that Byrne extrapolated, because we're coming back to that hard. So, you know, you go on through, and you've got things like the New York blackout, which was in an issue of which was one of our favorite comic books that's ever been released, which was the Marvel Team Up series. It was sort of in advance of the actual blackout. It was released into the comic books. There was a blackout in New York, which, honestly, not that prescient because of the fact that New York, during the 70s, had its fair share of public works issues. Look no further than the new Spider-Man movie and the What'd You Think on that to find out, to hear more about the issues that New York has with their infrastructure. But when you start looking at who was involved in that one, again, John Byrne wrote that, and it was it becomes, like Cole and I were discussing this, and it becomes pattern recognition at some point that comic books are by their very nature going to predict things that happen because they're in the popular consciousness.
Absolutely. And it's like, you know, it's not as obvious, I think, to comic readers at times that this sort of thing happens all the time in all entertainment media.
Right.
Is that someone will conceive of something because anything is possible. And because anything is possible, there's nothing that you can conceive of, you know, within reason, especially from the standpoint of events that could occur. There's literally nothing that a writer can conceive of that doesn't have potential to happen. And a lot of times the timing is such. And so a lot of times, you know, when movies or TV shows or comics or what have you will hit upon this sort of idea, and the timing of its arrival onto the scene is awkward.
Right.
You often hear about films like, was it Gangster Squad?
Or, Gangster Squad, yeah.
Or Men in Black 2, which pulled its original closing sequences and reshot everything and retooled it because it involved the Twin Towers. You know, these are things that occur that are kind of just zeitgeist, and we forget that when the timing is a little off. I remember reading about after Columbine that Stephen King was concerned about a short story he wrote, which was effectively the same idea.
Right.
And I think people were bringing that up who were aware of it. And, of course, you know, everyone tries to draw these connections that don't really exist. But it's one of those things where, you know, you have to understand that these movies, these anything, were weeks, months, years in production.
Right.
So the timing is often a little awkward, but it wasn't like they were trying to jump on the old tragedy bandwagon.
Right. When I worked for a company for a place that sold DVDs and CDs, like a big box retailer, and we used to do a thing called the dead spread. And this is a true story, and this is horrible, but it's true. when we knew as a company that. Well, at least as a store, that somebody was looking a little rough. I remember.
Oh, so you're doing the old Deadpool type of thing, where you were hedging your bets, as it were, on who might be the next to go.
We would, yeah, like I remember vividly. I think it was Frank Sinatra. I don't remember exactly, but when the report started coming in that it wasn't looking great for him, we would go through the store and pull out, you know, Frank Sinatra movies and Frank Sinatra CDs and pull them to the back, you know, some of them, in preparation for putting out the table upon his untimely demise that would have the black tablecloth and all the stuff set up on it. So that became known colloquially as the dead spread. It's not like comic books are doing that. You know, it's not like TV shows are doing that. These things have been shot, filmed, written. When you were discussing your Marvel story, your now patently famous Marvel story, which, by the way, still get comments about to this day about how ingenious that was. You know, we kind of got a glimpse into how long it takes to produce a comic book from inception to the shelf.
Oh, yes.
And it's a long time. It's not like you'll go to comic book conventions and you'll go to these panels and you know, people will discuss, hey, you know, did you guys plan for this or did you guys change it at the last minute? And, you know, these comic creators, these guys on these panels will say inevitably, like, I remember during Dark Reign there was one of those in Marvel where I went to a comic book panel and they said, well, did you plan to do this or was this just something that happened as a response to this happening? Or, you know, and they're like, guys, what you got to understand is this is written a year, you know, the idea is a year in advance. You know, the idea is, yeah, everything is written, everything is created. We came up with it on an outing, the last year's Marvel, you know, whatever hoedown camp outing that they do every year when they discuss the next year's huge events. And so no, like nobody's responding to anything. This is all planned out. We aren't idiots. We know what we're doing, and we know how to make something work. So I don't think people give the industry enough credit for all the jacked up stuff they might do about the planning and timing and logistics it takes to do something like this. So the other thing I wanted to talk about, and I don't know, you and I have never talked about this as far as I can remember, but then again, you and I have talked about so many things on and off the show that I don't know if we've ever discussed real life superheroes like Phoenix Jones. Yes. The guys that go out into the world, dress as superheroes and try to do good. I don't know if we've ever discussed that.
No, I mean, you know, and it's one of those things where I kind of raise an eyebrow because it's, do you really need to go and, you know, retool a Batman costume and, you know, strap three cans of mace and a billy club to your belt? Is all that necessary to do the good that they're doing?
Right.
And so it becomes a little bit of, I appreciate that you want to do this good, but it also seems smacks a bit of showboating.
Oh, it's definitely showboating. It's got to be, right? I mean, there are so many things you could do with your time. Like, for instance, look at, if you want to get dressed up in a costume and do good, and not have it be some kind of weird, you know, vigilante thing. Look at the 501st. Look at what the 501st does. Blood drives and charity drives and
yeah,
raising
that's
money.
Where you can take your fandom and make it into something worthwhile. If you're going to take it to the streets and, you know, foul up the operations of the crack dealer or thing, you know, other you know, well-meaning things like that, do you really need to go out and be flamboyant about it?
Well, I mean, at what point does it cross over into delusions of grandeur?
That's so true, yeah.
No, do you really think that you can do, you don't have superpowers? Let's just be, I'm just putting all the cards on the table. You don't, as much as I want to have superpowers, and I really believe that there's no one in the world that wants superpowers more than me. Or at least
that's true. You know, I've talked to a lot of comic fans, a lot of people, and I have never encountered anyone. Not even Pee Wee Herman in the stage show wanted some kind of superpower as much as you do.
No, right. Or at least live in a world where I could legitimize getting dressed in a costume and going outside to fight crime, even as just me. You know, because there's certain criteria, there's a syllabus that needs to be followed if I'm going to put on a half-assed Moon Knight costume and climb up on my roof. For that to at least be in some ways legitimate, in any way legitimate, you know, there has to be some kind of crime happening that either A, the cops can't get to, or B, is so far beyond the cops that they can't handle it. I mean, that's sort of what we're looking at. I understand you want to do good, and you can get a cat out of a tree in jeans and a t-shirt just as well as you can a pair of steampunk goggles and stilts. I'm just putting that on the table right now. And I'm a little bitter about it, because there's nothing, like I said, there's nothing more I would like to do than put on a costume and fight crime. But I also know that I'm going to do no good doing that. all I'm going to do is cause trouble. If I'm like, you know, if I'm carrying groceries across the street wearing a costume, I'm going to cause way more trouble than just carrying groceries across the street in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. So, all that being said, at what point do you really delve in? And I know we might catch heat, because we have some friends that listen to the show that might know some people that engage in this activity, and that's fine, but at what point do you have to say, I might be kind of crazy?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and more often than not, when you do hear about these stories of the real life superheroes, where you're taking the opposite, where the comics are then flowing into the real world, more often than not, every time you see coverage of this sort of thing, you have the cops saying, we wish they'd stop that.
Yeah, it's just, come on, guys.
Because it becomes a bit of a liability. You know, they don't need their job being made harder by, you know, some self-taught crime fighter.
Right.
It doesn't work that way in the real world.
No, it does not. It does not. Because as much as we hate to admit it, people actually do have rights. Sometimes, you know, like the Miranda rights exist for a reason.
Yeah.
Habeas corpus exists for a reason. Sentencing exists for a reason. We don't live in a world with the Hand and Kingpin and, you know, these people that are so far above the law that you've got to take it into your own hands because you're Matt Murdock and the system isn't working.
Like, swoop in and grab up the bad guys and then deposit them in front of the jail.
Right, which always cracked me up, right? And here's why. Like, whether you had Batman doing it or Spider-Man, you know, webbing him up on the lamppost.
Yeah.
The cops show up. Right.
And they got to do all the damn paperwork, and the superhero, meanwhile, gets to go jet off.
But it's not like, okay, so exactly, number one. Number two, it's not like you can be, it's not like you can call Spider-Man as an eyewitness, or even to tell you what these guys were doing in the first place, what charges should be brought up against them. You know, there's just guys that have probably been 8 hours upside down on a lamppost somewhere that attempted to rob a jewelry store across town and got away in their souped-up Chevy Nova, and you had to chase them across town, and then you finally caught them and zipped them up to a lamppost right there. And then the cops get there and go, I don't know what to do with these guys. Like, where did they come from? What did they do? They've got ski masks on. That's all we know. They got a bag. They had a giant bag with a dollar sign on it and ski masks. What do we do with this? So, in your research, what did you come across that you found interesting about this?
Well, one of the things that's really neat, and I think we hinted at this, and you and I talked about it a little bit before the show, and I really have to give credit to Andy for digging this up here. Is the talking on the times when purely by accident you get those things like the space plane rescue and the, you know, other things like some of the things that came out of the research were you know, Lex Luthor creating an atomic bomb,
right?
Before the atomic bomb was public domain. And what was interesting about that to me is I'd read an article years ago about forgive me if I mispronounce his name or misremember his name. I think the author's name was Martin Kaden, who was had written a book amongst his many, many, many books called Cyborg that was the basis for the $6 Million Man.
Okay.
And he was a consultant on that show, and the Bionic Woman both for their entire run, and I think they only picked up the phone and called him one time to help them get out of a plot hole they'd written themselves into. And but what was interesting about that is he was talking about when he was very young, starting out as an author, he had written a story in which he had not only predicted that the U.S. would create an atomic bomb. This was when he was a young kid in the 40s, like a teenager, writing for sci-fi magazines and stuff. He also accurately predicted the specific element, uranium-454.
Really? Wow.
And he was actually gathered up and questioned. What the hell, what gives here? And his initial reaction was, You actually went and built the damn thing?
Right? Like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah. And that was just another really good example of how these things happen, and we're powerless to stop them. But we discovered that one of the chief perpetrators of this, because of his overly active imagination, was none other than the Canadian comics powerhouse that is John Byrne.
And show favorite. Are we going to make it through five issues without talking about John Byrne at some point?
I don't think so.
I don't either, and that's fine. I'm okay with that. Yeah, John Byrne, God, not only is he prolific, I really think he is the Nostradamus of comic books. Or he has his finger so firmly placed on the pulse of popular culture that he can, a lot of times, infallibly predict he's like the Tony Stark of comic books. He's the futurist. He can predict what's coming and what's going to be popular.
And I think he also, you know, it's one of those things where inevitably it's the, in a way, a writer's mind is that room full of chimpanzees and typewriters.
Right.
And in that same sort of sense where eventually, by pure chance, one chimpanzee on one typewriter is going to accidentally reproduce Hamlet word for word.
Right. Right.
And in the, you know, in a case like this, I think that's why you get this sort of thing, and that's why you can point to a lot of things Byrne wrote, which were, like, eerily similar or on point to things that would happen later.
Right. John Byrne, even a broken clock is right 12 times a day.
That's true. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the one I wanted, I don't know if we touched on this or not, but the one of the ones that really, they got it kind of right until it kind of went sideways, okay? And until it went kind of nutty, was the beginning of the Civil War. And I don't know if you remember that. I don't remember it as vividly as I should, and I need to go back and read it. But the entirety of the Civil War was a reaction to what was an analogy for kind of mass school shootings. That's the way I read it, at least. They were at there was the school in Connecticut where I want to say it was Nuke exploded because they were fighting with the New Warriors.
Right. Yeah, the Marvel Civil War.
Right.
Yeah, it was, I guess Nuke was his name, but...
Uninspired,
I really, you know, at that point, I was so out of the Marvel Universe, it wasn't even funny.
But the idea was that it was all, the entirety of the Civil War was essentially an escalating reaction to this event happening, and this was the catalyst, and the catalyst was in my mind, when I read it, kind of a analogy, a one for one with these mass school shootings that were starting to become more and more prevalent and still are. I mean, we can't go through a week now without somebody pulling out a gun and shooting up a school. And I'm not going to go, even though this is our revisiting of our most our most tenuous of storylines as far as walking the line.
This is the one where you really, it's very difficult not to be provocative.
But a lot of things they did, I think that if something like that were to have happened in our real world. And what we're seeing happen is these comic books, as they're being more and more widely accepted, and Marvel even came out, I think it was a year ago, there, and Bobby and I, Bobby has talked on the show about it, Marvel's got this big push to kind of real world up their comic books. You know, kind of introduce more realism into the books. So you had this event take place, and then the entire, you know, superhero population sort of start to unravel, and you started having things like the Superhero Registration Act, comic book characters having to unmask and register with the government because they don't want events like this happening again. Which, you know, you had this huge fight. You had Captain America go underground and say, "I'm not, you know, I don't support this," and then you had Iron Man take the other side and say, you know, we all need to be accountable and responsible for our actions, and you know, convince Spider-Man to unmask during that period of time and all of that, which, you know, I again viewed as kind of a more veiled analogy for a gun control laws and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Which, believe me, being as I live now in Arizona, I am seeing that fight every single day. It's a big deal out here. So I think in a lot of ways they did that right, and of course it wandered into the lost forest of hyperbole at some point, and you got a bunch of weirdo comic book stuff happening at the same time. So but I think if you looked at it as an extrapolated analogy, I think it worked fairly well.
Yeah.
For that, is there any other instances like that that you can think of in comic books where something is on the popular conscience and comic books use that to explode it and make it larger than life?
Early on, like every entertainment media at the time, September 11th was something that was, that entered the comics because it affected drastically everything.
Right.
And everyone was struggling to figure out what do we do? How do we approach this? How do we, where do we go from here? How can we still do what we did? And, it was kind of unfortunate that a lot of things like, the Daily Show, it took years for them to stop being somber and just having, political and social people on the show and get back to having fun again.
Right.
And I think the comics did a little bit better job of doing what they could to pay tribute, to, give due deference, but to then return to being an escape again. And personally, I always felt that the greatest strength that you could give to what happened, the greatest surrender to that would be to just stop living, to stop being the people we were before that happened.
Right.
Because in that way, you're saying, well, you won. You did exactly what you set out to do, and in many ways, that was allowed to happen. Because this is my turn to kind of wax social and philosophical. But, I think that once we started letting ourselves go back to what made us great culturally, we sort of won ourselves back from that. And the comics did a good job of saying, no, it's okay for your Supermans to get killed or your there to be strife. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, the Civil War storyline happened, was brought into Marvel at a period after 9/11, when it would have seemed almost, it would have been so easy to stay away from anything controversial.
Right. And that's the thing, is that everybody was looking for controversy after 9/11. Everything could have been considered controversy after 9/11. And comic books were some of the first things to say, we're going to continue to do what we do. We're going to spend a couple months, giving our due deference, but in order to really be patriotic, we're going to provide entertainment and social commentary, and we're going to look at what's happening in the world, and we're going to spell it out for you, because if we don't, like you said, then effectively what they've attempted to have happen will win. We can't do that. We can't let that happen.
Yeah.
And it did happen in 2006, so... So it did happen after, and during
wars. Yeah, the thing
wars
is that it was so many things just went by the wayside because of, and the same thing happens, when something tragic happens, and there are those similarities and stuff. But I think that the comics did a great job of springing back and becoming that escape without turning into the 50s comics, the post
right.
Comics code comics. We didn't get all silly and goofy and, let's just tell happy tales.
Or be wholesale propaganda, which is what the other side of that is.
Opposite. Yeah, and there were some who tried to play that card, and I really felt that did a great disservice to the country as well, honestly, is this sort of, you know, the whole Team America, America, yeah, you know, kind of attitude that...
You know what? You know, we never talked about... Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, though, that there are just a lot of things that will happen in the real world that are going to happen in comics, and we need to be okay with that, because it's going to happen. It's always happened. I'm sure you could go back to, you know, it had to have been like Greek playwrights who weren't handed down through the ages, because they'd have to write something, and then, you know, the Etruscans came and crushed a couple of the major cities and ruined the trade for a few years, and they'd already written this play, and it was performed the same week, and everybody's too soon.
What's Greek for too soon? I need to call somebody.
One guy had shown up, you know, from Marathon and with the news, and they're like, how could I know? I've been writing this play for a year and a half.
The term "don't shoot the messenger" exists for a reason.
Yes, exactly.
You know what? I just literally just dawned on me that we have not talked about on this show. I don't know if we've talked about it once, but it definitely applies to what we're talking about right now. And it's one of those things that why we haven't talked about this yet baffles me. And if we have, please correct me. We haven't talked about the Nom at all on this show.
No, we haven't. Yeah, the sort of the historical, or at least semi-historical, semi-autobiographical type of comic.
Right. Well, I mean, the Nom went from 86 to 93, and Larry Hama did the editing, editing on that, and Michael Golden and Doug Murray did the book, but it was all about the Vietnam War. And they brought in some of the real stories and things that happened during Vietnam. It wasn't, you know, just a book. It was, I remember reading it and being really interested in it. But that's one of those ones that they made based on a real life event, and it wasn't a one shot. It wasn't just a thing that, okay, we're going to pay deference to this, or we're going to include this as a cash grab. This was, we're going to do an entire series on Vietnam, and it's going to be popular enough to go for 6 years. That's impressive.
Yes, that is. I remember when that first came out, I bought the first couple of issues, and it didn't speak to me as a reader. I mean, I knew going in, I didn't go in thinking it was going to be like, you know, I certainly didn't go in expecting that Frank Castle would eventually to tie it into the Marvel Universe, which I thought was a great disservice, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
After I began to appreciate what they were doing there, that they felt they had to sex up Vietnam by adding fictional characters. And, you know, at that point, just bring in Fin Fang Foom to step on Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah, it could have been worse, but they still probably shouldn't have done it. I'm just...
But, you know, that's an interesting point, is that, you know, there are points where reality creeps into comics, where the public consciousness informs a story. There are points where a story seems to have a strange parallel.
Right.
And then there was... And then there are times where, you know, you have that kind of biographical or historical comic, and certainly, you know, one of the things I was avoiding in Religion on Comics is talking about comics about religious figures. There was actually a Marvel comic about St. Francis.
Was there really?
Yes, it actually, you know, has the Marvel logo and everything.
Oh, weird.
The story of St. Francis. I don't know why they felt compelled to do that. Maybe they were like, you know, when Larry Flint found Jesus or something, just for a month. And...
No, this one for me was really cool, because it walked that line of comic book and then historical comic, because it wasn't a full on historical comic like Classics Illustrated or something
exactly.
Like that. It was a comic book with comic book art and an actual you know, a literary and editorial mandate to make the comic. They had storylines, they had story arcs, and yes, they did indeed have Punisher that showed up at the end of the run.
Yeah, and I think at that point maybe all bets were off or something. But, you know, early on, I think initially Michael Golden was the artist attached to that.
Right.
Which was really one of the reasons I got, you know, into it in the first place.
Because of his Batman work?
Actually, I feel in the, I discovered Michael Golden, I'm trying to think of where, Micronauts, of course.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Hey, you did a really good job on Micronauts. Do you want to draw the NAM? What?
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, I guess they were trying to find something to do, and they didn't have any, it could have been one of those cases where there just weren't
the NAM.
Projects that were, like, high, you know, somebody was already on Iron Man or everything else, and or maybe, you know, Larry Hama, if I'm not mistaken, I should...
It is, yes.
To Larry Hama.
Of course it is. We saw him eat breakfast. We know it was him.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, sad breakfast man.
Sad breakfast Hama.
I just, oh, wow. I just had this thought of, like, do a show called Hama and Eggs, you know, like a little morning show.
A little morning show. Yeah. Maybe you can get him back at Alcon. You can arrange that for one morning.
But, you know, maybe... He requested him. I don't know, but yeah, I kind of got into it just to see what it was all about, and that was also the period where where the Golden was doing a lot more exaggeration in his art.
Yeah,
and that kind of was off-putting to me. So that was one of the other reasons I kind of dropped out of that.
Yeah, but you know, I know it got it was fairly well received. For being what it was, I mean, you've got Marvel Comics, and in the late 80s and early 90s, we've discussed what had happened in Marvel. You know, we've discussed, because Jim Shooter was involved in this, we discussed that Marvel was kind of, you know, doing everything they could in the superhero realm to make money and create, you know, create traction in the superhero world, and then they come out with The Nob, which is sort of a high concept for comic books, especially for a major publisher. You don't see that a lot. It was weird enough when you saw stuff like, what was the, what was the name of the Damage Control, which is still one of my favorites. Like, that was pretty high concept for what it was, but The Nom is really high concept, so that was interesting. Hey, I think it's time that we start wrapping it up, Cole.
Are we getting about that time?
It's about that time already.
Yeah, the only other thing I could, I think, you know, we touched on the presidents and such, and I don't remember if we talked about this last time, but I know we've talked about it somewhere at some point, was the Marvel team-up with the Not Ready for Primetime Players.
Is that the one you have on your wall?
It is the one I have on my wall.
Yeah.
I tracked it down. It's a fun read because they do a good job of trying to make the characters, the actual people in it, seem like they, you know, you imagine they might be behind the scenes.
Yeah. And, you know, they have a long history. Marvel and DC, but I remember a lot more in Marvel, have a long history of bringing in comedians and people like that into their books. David Letterman classically was in one of the books. Like you said, the Not Ready for Primetime Players. You had the Jim Belushi as the Samurai Deli character.
Yeah, that was the whole thing revolved around this ridiculous notion that someone accidentally sent John Belushi a ring that was supposed to go to Silver Samurai.
It's not a bad for what it is, though.
Yeah,
it's not bad.
And it's kind of fun because, you know, everybody kind of gets involved with fighting the Silver Samurai.
Right, it's not bad. It's like, for a book that could have been really awful, like...
Yeah.
Like Spider
Lee is in it as well, so he was the guest host for the night. So, you know, mayhem is ensuing. But
it's awesome. That's great. Like, I need to get my hands on a copy of that. I haven't tried hard enough to get my hands on a copy of that book. So I need to look into doing that. All right. I think we have wrapped up another story arc, Cole.
Indeed we have, and it was great to go back and revisit this. You know, we planned early on if we'd had time to get in and listen to the episodes and, you know, make sure we weren't repeating ourselves and things like that. But at the end of the day, I'm kind of happy with the way it went because we weren't trying too hard to avoid topics. We weren't trying too hard to touch on something we'd already talked about.
Yeah, exactly. And the things that we brought back up, I think we brought back up because we had new insight into them after doing this for so long, and things have changed in the world. So it made sense, and it was fun. It was fun to do, and I really enjoyed it. Next week, we are going back to a time-honored tradition in Hey Kids Comics that Cole brought around back in our Collector Sector days, which was the damn you San Diego Comic-Con for not being willing to take my money, even though I'm trying to give it to you, because I'm not at San Diego Comic-Con to buy your exclusives. So every year we've done one now where we discuss the exclusives that are coming to San Diego Comic-Con and what we don't have and what we want to have and why does this exist and why doesn't this exist at my house right now. So expect that next week with guest seminal Hey Kids Comics San Diego Comic-Con exclusive show guest Rick Gutierrez. I think he's been on every one now. And that's gonna be next week, and that'll be way too much fun because I already know from Cole that there's like 17 things that he wants.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Cole, do you have any plugs for this guy? You wanna throw some plugs in it? You wanna little boy blue this thing?
All right. Well, let's just blow on through these here real quick. We of course have coming to us, of course, through the auspices of the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com.
Auspices.
You can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. You can follow us on Twitter at The Jedi Cole U, which Andrew set up for me and I actually use from time to time.
Couldn't be more proud.
You can find us on Facebook under Hey Kids Comics. And you can also find the Jedi Cole Universe under Hey Kids Comics, as well as the Rantcore Pit, where it's the bi-weekly pre-recorded show, which alternates with the bi-weekly live show, the Rantcore Pit Live.
Right.
Which is on a bit of a scheduling hiatus right now. It'll be back on the pre-recorded show. We're just changing the schedule up a bit. And let's see, where else can you find us? You can check out conventions in the state of Texas all year long at Convention Awareness Project Texas at conventionawarenesstx.blogspot.com. And you can, of course, find Andrew, myself, Catherine, and others on the United States of Geekdom at unitedstatesofgeekdom.com.
That's right. So thank you, Cole, again. This seems like a good time because we're discussing our first story arc, and we're wrapping that up to remind you how much you mean to me and to the podcasting community as a whole. You've given us a playground and a bunch of shows to listen to and a place to spread our proverbial wings and hyperbolically fly, because if I could actually fly, I'd put on my Moon Knight costume and fight crime.
No, I know. You'd be like Dave Foley on that episode of The Tick where he's stealing Arthur's costume and he's running around his office while the theme song from Greatest American Hero is playing.
I was just going to say I would be more like the Greatest American Hero than any comic book character I know of. I'd be like Captain America from the first Captain America movie. And I'm not talking about the new ones. I'm talking about floppy shield 70s van Captain America. So, thank you, Cole. And in all honesty, and I'm sure I speak for everyone when I say thank you for everything you've done for us, for conventions, for AllCon, for podcasting, and for being the best friend I could ask for. So thank you, man.
Thank you. This has been an amazing journey.
And it will continue. And in another 90 episodes, we'll revisit some of our favorites. We've got some that we're going to have to do a choose your own five pack of stories to revisit soon. Because there's a bunch of them that I really want to go back through and look at again. So, until next week, when we commiserate together over not being able to go to San Diego Comic-Con and buy things, buy, collect, and enjoy your comics, especially comics that do their best to fold reality into their pages, because there's a lot of social commentary there that's really amazing. Speaking of, and I'm gonna go out on a limb here, and I'm gonna tell Cole this right now. The Lego Movie. Did you ever see that, or did you You stood by your.
Decision not to go see it.
Well, it's out on DVD now, so if you can get to a Redbox and rent it, I went and saw it last week. I cannot suggest strongly enough you see it solely for the social commentary involved.
Okay.
It's actually really good, and I wouldn't steer you astray. So my vote is that you and Catherine sit down and watch it. I think you're actually going to really, really enjoy it.
I'm gonna have to give it a chance after all. Just don't tell Rick.
I won't. I'm not going to tell Rick.
Show, and that'll be that.
That's right. All right. So until next week, I'm your host, Andrew Farmer, and there's my co-host and producer over there, Cole Houston. You want to say goodnight, Cole?
Good night, everybody, and thank you for making this. We are rapidly approaching our second year on this show.
And we've got an annual coming up. We're not going to tell you.
We've got another annual. Yes, we do. So we'll be having an announcement about that very soon.
And we're not going to tell you what it's about, but you'll enjoy it. All right, until next week, everybody, enjoy your comics and start opining over San Diego Comic-Con. Good night, everybody.